New South Wales state of chaos, too many jobs, not enough pay, and the good news is about the air. This is The Week on Wednesday. Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am your co-host, Ben Davison, and I am joined from our nation's capital by the great, the glorious, the best-selling author of QAnon and On, A Short and Shocking History of Internet Conspiracy Cults, and my co-host for The Week on Wednesday, live at Melbourne Fringe on the 12th of October, my wife and your friend, Van Badham. How are you, Van?
Well, I'm in Canberra, and can I tell you, it's a very different trip than the one I had planned.
Indeed. The whole nation seems to have ground to a proverbial halt, or at least while things are going on underneath the surface, the media has become completely preoccupied. And, of course, our nation's parliament is not sitting because of the death of Queen Elizabeth II.
Yes. So I'm in Canberra for numerous reasons. I'm in Canberra because I'm here to address the WIMDOI conference, which is the Women in Male-Dominated Industries conference, which is going to be awesome. That's tomorrow. But I was here to represent one of my unions, because I'm a member of two because I'm such a union girl, which is the Australian Writers Guild, which is one of a group of unions with the Australian Directors Guild and MIA and various other arts organisations who want to boost the amount of money that's devoted to making Australian film and television. We think that's quite important. So we were going to be here. The secretary of the guild, Claire Pullen, who's an awesome comrade of mine, we're all going to be here. We were going to meet people and talk about how awesome, you know, Australian content is and how great it would be for media jobs to stay in this country. And then the Queen died.
And the media became preoccupied by that.
Can I just say, I mean, it's one thing, irrespective of anybody's feelings about the Queen dying, and of course, Ben and I did have a full disclosure, we are Republicans conversation about that on the weekend. So if you want to revisit that conversation, the weekend wrap, Ben and I had a chat about it. Like, the Queen is dead and Canberra is a cemetery. I mean, I actually like Canberra. Like, as you know, I have bullied you into coming to Canberra more than once because the art gallery is amazing, the gardens are amazing. I find it very chilled out, a very relaxing kind of place. But I would say at the moment it's a bit too relaxing, Ben. I mean, it's a neo-brutalist treasure. We all know that about Canberra, but it is very quiet outside.
I like Canberra. Let's not create mythology here. I like Canberra. I wouldn't particularly like to go there every couple of weeks and sit around in a palace surrounded by a big fence or anything. But, you know, I do like our nation's capital. There's a lot going for it. There's a lot of lovely people there, a lot of interesting national monuments to see, galleries, and all sorts of lovely things about Canberra. So, you know, I mean, I would say this. I think the WIMDOI conference is such an excellent initiative of the trade union movement because, as we've discussed many times, Van, on The Week on Wednesday, we do have the most gender segregated workforce in the OECD. And of course, the union movement wants to break that down because we know, unfortunately, the more feminized an industry is, the lower the pay tends to be. This has played out over many, many decades in this country. So I'm sure that conference will still be a fantastic opportunity and experience to help address some of those issues. And of course, anyone who's listening to this podcast should be joining their union because the topics we're going to talk about today, we've had to dig underneath the headlines a little bit in the news because it's also royal dominated.
Queenie, queenie, queen, 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 queenie, queen, queen.
Well, you know, you should be joining your union. If you're not a member of your union and you're listening to this podcast for the first time and you're not a member, but by the time you've finished listening, send us a note and we'll explain to you why you must join. You can join online at australianunions.org.au/WOW, that's W-O-W. Because, Van, we've seen announced today that in New South Wales, there's obviously been ongoing, what people might call industrial strife in New South Wales, but it's probably more accurately described as governmental chaos. And now, today, the Rail, Tram and Bus Union, the RTBU, and Unions New South Wales have have announced that they will be turning off the ticket machines at train stations from Wednesday next week. So that's not today, but that's a week from today, so that people can't be fined and you don't have to buy a ticket and you can ride the rails. And this is in response to 18 months of negotiation and discussion. And fundamentally, Van, the Paratay Liberal government in New South Wales has been positioning this as a dispute about pay, when in fact it's about something very different, isn't it?
It's about safety. You know, it's about the conditions that the RTBU, as the people who make the public transport work, know have to be in place for the system to be safe. I mean, New South Wales has been dealing with a litany of appalling decisions around transport. It's constantly, unlike Victoria, where the government, the Andrews Labor government, has had the priority of making trains and public transport infrastructure in Victoria, who would believe it? The New South Wales Liberal government of Perrottet and before him Berejiklian prioritised importing transport infrastructure from overseas with very perilous results. We've seen like cracks in the like fuselage of public transport. You have obviously the situation with the world's most scenic tram route. It is literally faster to run past the tram than catch the tram in parts of Sydney. Okay. Fine. I mean, we begged for light rail in Sydney for so long and then got it and all right, no problem. But there has been this ongoing problem where the RTBU has been talking about like what they need to maintain appropriate safety standards on the network, and the government just won't do it. I want to put this in context of New South Wales as a state of chaos, because it's not just the public transport unions that have been kicking off. It's the teachers' unions in New South Wales as well. There have been issues to do with the health system in New South Wales. Like, just to remind everybody, federal industrial law sets the framework. The industrial laws about what unions can and can't do, how things are arbitrated, that's all set federally. The days of, you know, state-based industrial courts are long over. So when you have one state government that is repeatedly at the centre of protests and strike action and industrial disputes, eventually you have to reach the point of thinking, maybe, just maybe, it's that government's fault.
Well, absolutely. And I've seen some things flying around online from the New South Wales Nurses and Midwives Association. That's the state-based New South Wales Nurses Union, obviously, talking about how New South Wales nurses are falling behind their colleagues in Queensland and Victoria. But Van, you know, we've had some people contact us who work on the rails, who work in public transport in New South Wales, you know, and we mentioned it, I think, last week, that there had been some commuters, a very small number of commuters, who were trying to, you know, lay the blame at or abuse the workers who do this work and who are taking this action. And I want to put this into context because I think...
Don't pick a fight with the person who's packing your parachute.
Well, I think it's really important to realise that the Perrottet government offered an $18,000 payment to the workers to drop their safety concerns. Now, the workers refused to do that. I don't think that's had a lot of coverage or enough coverage, certainly not enough coverage, because fundamentally what we have to remember here is that most workers, and we covered this off when we talked about Qantas as well, you know, the Qantas engineers who are concerned about the safety of the planes, that they stay at Qantas despite the poor treatment, despite being offered more money to go elsewhere because they're dedicated to seeing the national carrier stay safe. This is the same thing with the rail workers in New South Wales. They're not prepared to trade off safety for money in their own pocket. By the same token, we as a society need to stand with them and say that they shouldn't have to pay for our safety out of their pocket. In fact, it's beholden on the New South Wales state government to deliver safe, reliable public transport and pay decent, appropriate wages. That's what we should all be aiming for in every state and territory around the country. So, you know, I do think it's important that we do put the blame, if you like, for this issue where it really resides, and that is with the Perrottet government.
it's interesting because Elliott, who's the transport minister now, Elliott was complaining. He's, you know, issued a press release to News Limited saying that the action that the RTBU are taking, which I think is ingenious. So you will be able to catch your train, but you'll be able to catch it for free. I'm trying to see how the public is not going to be on board with this pretty quickly. And quite honestly, if there are concerns about the safety of the rail network, but paying to use a network that is not meeting reasonable expectations of what safety constitutes, I think it's fair enough, and I think it actually communicates the message from the union to the commuters of New South Wales that they're on the public side. You can just imagine Elliott, Perrottet and the rest of them, the rage that's overtaking them given the fact that this is quite a positive PR move on behalf of the union, because Elliott was out saying that turning off the Opal machines, and the Opal is the electronic ticket that you use in New South Wales to travel, would bleed the state dry. It would bleed the state dry. That would be it. It would just bleed the state dry and the union so unreasonable. And it's like again and again and again, workers do not take this much action. Like the amount of action workers take is proportional to the intensity of worker concern. And I'm a bit older than you, which is something that we revisit on this show quite often. But when the massive anti-union drives were beginning in the 1970s and cascaded through the 1980s from the Liberals and, you know, neoliberals and neoconservatives determined to bust unions so they could live in their trickle-down free market neoliberal wonderland, what we were always told, we were told about fat cat public servants. Oh, you know, public servants were lazy, public servants didn't do anything. We needed to make these systems efficient and we needed to, you know, put some commercial energy into these operations. And again and again and again, the propaganda message was that public servants don't do anything for you. Well, we have a community of workers in New South Wales, not only in transport, but also in teaching and also in health, who are making it very clear that their standards are about servicing the public, that these are public servants who actually want to participate in service. And it indicates, Ben, I mean, you'll be shocked by this, and I realise this is a controversial statement, that maybe the anti-union campaigns of neoliberals in the 70s and 80s were a lie.
Absolutely a lie. And I think it absolutely should just hammer home that point to people that in unionised workplaces, safety is held to a much higher standard. There are less incidents. There is better pay. People have more secure employment. People have more sane employment. They tend to be more productive workplaces as well. I mean, this idea, there are 13,000 workers in the public transport sector in New South Wales alone, 13,000. And that's because it's a big state that has a huge, Sydney has a huge footprint that has to be serviced. And there is no question that to get millions of people around that city so seamlessly is a highly productive effort, but it also needs to be a safe effort. And quite frankly, we know that privatisation leads to more safety incidents. We've seen it happen in just the provision of the ferries, in the way the trains are set up. All these things are already happening in New South Wales. But let me also say this, Van. You know, one of the stories I want to talk about today is the numbers that have come out that show more Australians than ever before are working multiple jobs. Now, I remember when we started doing The Week on Wednesday, we had a story about how more Australians than ever before were working multiple jobs. That number has gone up again. Why? Because in insecure employment, where there's an opportunity for profiteering, that's what private businesses are doing. So it's so important we stand with these transport workers because it's not just their job, it's about the conditions we set across the economy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the reasons why it's so important to fight privatisation and to ensure that public jobs stay in public hands and that there are structures of integrity around what jobs for the public in the public service, in transport, admin, anything look like, is because the working conditions, whether it's the state of job security, working hours, rights at work, allowances, anything else, in the public service, they set the standard for the commercial sector as well. Because why would you work in the commercial sector if you could work a government job that had security and stability and all those things? And obviously, enormous amounts of corporate money have gone towards anti-public service campaigns and anti-public servant campaigns over the past few decades, because the corporate sector know that if government jobs stay good and secure and strong, that they, the corporate sector, have to raise their standards in order for their jobs to be worth doing.
They have to compete. And that, I mean, that's the great irony, right? And look, you know, we are now at a moment in time here in this country where, for the first time, I think probably in my lifetime, we have public sector wages growing less rapidly than private sector wages because of the way that the Morrison government, the Perrottet government, those two governments in particular, set about trying to undermine public sector wages. Of course, when I say public sector wages are growing less rapidly than private sector wages, everybody's been copying pay cuts, right? That's to say that the public sector has received bigger pay cuts than the private sector has received. And this is at a time with supposedly record levels of employment, where we have record low levels of unemployment. You know, we can't dissociate all these intersecting factors. You know, an economy is just millions of individual decisions that get made every single day. It's not a mythical being. It's not a magical pot plant that we grow.
Nobody has invisible hands.
No, none of that. All of those kind of metaphors and analogies that people like to use to pretend that somehow or another it's something mythical. It's not. It's
growing the pie.
Growing a pie.
Growing a pie? Like, what does that even mean? You can't grow pies. They're not organic.
But, you know, it is decisions that are made. And I think that the, you know, the ACTU put out a statement today about the fact that the idea that we could have more people working multiple jobs, and particularly in the health and care sectors, which are supposedly growing parts of the economy where we supposedly have labour shortages, people working multiple jobs that are not full-time. It's not as though people are working a full-time job and then taking extra hours to, you know, put away more money. No, no, people are working multiple jobs of sort of a part-time nature or a casual nature, of an insecure nature, because that's what they're being offered, because that's how certain employers, too many employers, are undermining their ability to negotiate higher wages. And it's ridiculous. It shows how broken the system is. And I have to say, again, credit to the RTBU and the 13,000 transport workers in New South Wales who have said, no, we're not going to be part of a broken system. We're not going to take the cash that Perrottet is offering to shut up and let safety standards slip. And I think fundamentally we all have to say that this system doesn't work. You know, we were promised low unemployment would lead to higher wages. Well, we've got record low unemployment and we've got record wage cuts. You know, profit is being taken out of the system by unproductive capital. People are working multiple jobs.
And, of course, we know from studies that the ACTU compiled in this area about holding down multiple jobs, that the more jobs you have, the less money you are likely to earn. So this idea of side hustles and a bit extra, that's not how this system is working. You know, the idea that casualized labor is something that exists on the side, well, it's like thinking eating 20 small packets of chips counts as a meal. That's not how this works.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And of course, that's why the Jobs and Skills Summit was so important. And it's why we always say, join your union. Go to australianunions.org.au/wow. That's WW for the week on Wednesday. Van, look, the other piece of news that I think it's worth us talking about is that the situation in Ukraine is developing, and people might be kind of catching snippets of it, but I know you follow this pretty closely. What is going on? Because the Russian offensive seems to have stalled. Am I right in saying that?
Well, lots of things have been going on. And for people who may have been paying less attention to the war in Ukraine, where we're at now is that there have been some momentous events over the past week. And I have been following it very closely because the stakes of what's happening in Ukraine are much higher for the Western democracies than maybe a lot of news coverage has suggested. And certainly the commentary that I follow has been very clear about the stakes of that war in particular. So Ukraine, of course, is a sovereign nation in its own right. It is a former Soviet republic and has had this, you know, historical imperial relationship with Russia, which is a separate country. And of course, it gained its independence with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Like a lot of new democracies, had not necessarily the smoothest path to sovereignty, but certainly with the election of Volodymyr Zelensky, who is a former TV comedian famous for playing Hava Nagila on a piano with his anatomy. I think you can look at the YouTube. It is extraordinary. Zelensky was elected on a promise of fighting corruption. You and I are great fans of his TV show, Servant of the People, which is very funny, except extremely bleak, because most of the places of the people, we know the theme song, if not in Ukrainian. But Zelensky played an ordinary guy who becomes president of Ukraine in this TV show and then ran for office to be an ordinary guy who became president of Ukraine. And of course, somebody described him this week as like, I can't remember, it was something like if Dick Van Dyke all of a sudden found himself in the role of Winston Churchill, except it's real and there's a war on, is basically what's happening. And what's become very clear since Russia literally rolled the tanks into Ukraine in February is that the Russians under Vladimir Putin have drifted from its sort of post-Soviet shaky Yeltsinist democracy to an autocracy. I mean, you take great amusement in recounting how Putin was president and then they had term limits and his friend Dmitry Medvedev became prime minister and then Putin was prime minister again. And how does it work? I can't remember the order.
Putin was president. He was term limited out. So he made the prime minister the president, made himself prime minister until they could quote unquote fix the constitution. They fixed the constitution and then Putin has been president again ever since. And, you know, the speculation is he will be for life. But, I mean, his invasion has been a shambles. His invasion of Ukraine has been a shambles. The West has supported Ukraine with materials. And now it looks as though Zelensky and the Ukrainians are taking the offensive back.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, what's happened in the past week is that the Ukrainians have taken the offensive and they did something quite amazing in this era of like perpetual electronic surveillance and information war, was that they managed to run a disinformation campaign, take that, Russia, taste of your own medicine, insisting that they were going to move on the south and on Kherson, which is a significant territory that's been under Russian occupation. And they kept talking about, you know, this southern offensive and this southern counterattack to reclaim territory that the Russians have occupied after the invasion of February. And in fact, they attacked to the northeast and absolutely ripped through the Russians in the northeast of Ukraine in the occupied areas. They've liberated more than 200 villages and towns in the past couple of days. They've taken over and they've retaken, rather, an area that is something like the combined landmass of San Francisco and New York, of Greater New York and Greater San Francisco, like sizable tracts of land. Somebody has said that they've gained or regain more territory in a week than the Russians have since February. And you're getting reports in the Washington Post and the New York Times about the Russian retreat running faster than Olympic runners. And there are incredible scenes, like there's footage of sons returning to their hometowns and liberating their mothers from occupation. And there was an amazing piece today where somebody was saying that they had confirmed that their mother was still alive, but she didn't have time to talk when they reconnected because she was busy listing traitors to give to the Ukrainian army. And it's quite incredible what's happened. American intelligence, the American authorities, obviously America is Ukraine's ally, although you could have been forgiven for thinking they were Russia's during the Trump administration, but certainly during the Biden administration, we're siding with the democracy, that the Americans are saying that this isn't game over, Red Rover for the Russians, but it is certainly a turning point in the war. And I mean, and it's important, the American involvement is important, the involvement of NATO is important, because Ukraine, you know, a flawed place like everywhere else, it has had systemic corruption problems that Zelensky was elected to deal with and were being dealt with very slowly. And it wasn't necessarily as much political optimism as you would hope about the path to non-corruption in Ukraine. But Russia is an autocracy. It is not a democratic country. Elections in that country are a sham. Putin rules by decree. And this war in Ukraine is an act of imperialism. It is an imperialist war about a former imperial power, Russia, trying to take land from people who have a sovereign claim over it. And it is very important that the democracies of the world back in our comrades, the Ukrainians, who are fighting for their existence against an autocracy. And of course, it has made a difference, Western help, and Australia has been part of that mobilization. We gave Bushmaster all-terrain vehicles to the Ukrainians. The Americans have given them these HIMARS weapons, which are heavy artillery that are highly mobile. So, of course, traditional artillery, very, very heavy, the bigger the bomb. If you fire it and it lands, you might kill a lot of people, but they'll know where you have shot from and be able to destroy your artillery. Well, these new weapons, they can shoot and then head off extremely quickly. And Max Boot, who's a writer for the Washington Post, a sort of military analyst, was talking this week about what the Ukrainians have done with these weapons, demonstrated in this sort of lightning advance, this lightning counteroffensive that's taken place in the northeast around Kharkiv in Ukraine. It's like engineers learning how to fly a plane while it's in the air, that they have literally just built their tactics and their strategy around the use of these weapons that they'd never seen before until they turned up in boxes, you know, as donations from allies in order to fight back the Russians. But what it's exposed about the Russians is that old saying, a fish rots from the head, is very pertinent. A lot of military experts and military policy people are talking about how the problem with Russia, which is this intensely nepotistic, corrupt, autocratic regime where power is concentrated in Putin and he picks favorites and, you know, everything is corrupt and there are no actual structures of meritocracy, has meant that this is reflected in the army. Like, people are saying military reflects the society that created it. There's no discipline in the Russian forces. Somebody made this joke that before this war, people thought the Russians had the second best army in the world, and now they only have the second best army in Ukraine. You know, and there are stories emerging of, I'm sure people have seen footage of Russian soldiers just frantically looting Ukrainian apartment buildings and stealing rugs. Mm. Well, one of the reasons why they were stealing rugs is that the Russian army hadn't supplied them with blankets. That what happens with a lot of army supplies is that they get stolen by the people who are supposed to be handing them out to soldiers, and soldiers then have to find themselves having to buy their own kit on eBay. Like, this is an actual thing.
Yeah, and I mean, I saw some footage of some of the so-called Russian-speaking Ukrainians who've been roped into the Russian army being supplied with pre-World War II-era rifles, helmets, no body armor, no food. I mean, it's a pretty dire situation. The great threat of, you know, Russian armor sweeping across Eastern Europe into Germany and France seems to have evaporated more quickly than the stolen fuel from their tank depots.
Well, I mean, it's everything. I mean, you've talked before about the tires, because the army's so corrupt and nothing's done properly and there's no real clear lines of accountability in the Russian army, that they had all of these great all-terrain tires, but they didn't do basic maintenance on them. So they got to Ukraine, and all the trucks that were using these tires were just completely shredded. Ukraine is covered in bits of tank, like tanks that have broken down because they haven't been properly maintained. One of the reasons why they've been stealing refrigerators and washing machines is because the effect of the sanctions has been Russia is running out of microchips, and there are microchips in fridges and washing machines that the Russians have been ordered to collect so they can have any weapons. The Ukrainians have taken vast amounts of weaponry from the Russians just in the past couple of days, like numerous tanks. They're finding arms depots and artillery stockpiles, all of these sort of bits of infrastructure that the Russians have just fled and abandoned that the Ukrainians are now getting. I mean, it's incredible. But there's another really important point that Paul Krugman, who writes for the New York Times, is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, was making this point about there's quite a lot of significance in what's happening in Ukraine in terms of the MAGA movement and the far right in Europe, and but certainly in America, that the sort of Trumpists, a lot of commentators, people like Tucker Carlson and Ted Cruz, the worst person in the world, have over the years absolutely fated the Russian army because Putin is homophobic and, you know, it's all masculinist and they don't have women in these service roles and they promote these sort of, you know, an army of big buffy blokes carrying guns around. Whereas the Ukrainians, 20% of the Ukrainian Territorial Defense Force are women. And you've also had in Ukraine troops who are LGBTQIA, like people who know that under Russian occupation, their lives would be totally expendable to just the institutional homophobia of the Putinist autocracy. And they call them the unicorn troops. So you have LGBTQIA soldiers who wear a patch with literally the world's most dangerous looking unicorn, who are in the armed services and who are fighting to defend their country and defend their freedom. And of course, that's having a huge effect on what it means to be Ukrainian. Like, Ukraine is a country where women are equal and LGBTQIA people are proving their right to social equality by engaging in the defense of a homeland. They are literally living their emergence as a modern, smaller liberal country against this, you know, Russian monstrosity. And, you know, the army of big buffy blokes is getting absolutely routed. And Krugman makes the point, like, if you have bigotries and prejudices and corruption and these deferrals to these weird, unnatural hierarchies, it means you actually keep your most courageous, your most impassioned, your most brilliant, your most talented, your most capable out of your armed services. And you can't afford to do that in a war. And, you know, this centralization of command in Russia, where everything flows from the top down, it means that, you know, decision making takes a long time. Logistics become really complicated. You know, if the boss doesn't tell you to do it, well, you don't do it. Whereas the Ukrainians have mobile leadership as well. They give power to small mobile units who are able to make battlefield decisions and maximize opportunities. And people are saying, like, this is modern war, and the advantage goes to the army with modern attitudes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, there's still a long way to go, but it's certainly heartening to see Ukraine on the offensive, Russia on the defensive. And, you know, the predictions that Russia would win in 3 hours, well, that's certainly proven not to be true. But, Van, I want to talk about some good news before we give shout-outs to our cadre and extend the Reach supporters. Because, you know, in these troubled times, it can feel like there's not a lot of good news. Although, you know, some might say that the collapsing Putinista army is good news in of itself. But there is also good news about hydrogen being extracted from air. This story, I think, is just fantastic on so many levels. It's a story about Australian innovation where chemical engineers here in Australia have developed a hydroscopic gel which absorbs moisture from the air. Once inside the gel, it's split via electrolysis into hydrogen and oxygen. 10 square feet of this spongy material can produce 24 gallons of pure hydrogen every hour, and the scientists are calculating that 100 square feet can replace natural gas for an entire family home, and that it even works under a bone dry environment, which of course in Australia we have plenty of.
Lots of bones, lots of dries.
Exactly. This process can be solar powered as well. So we've moved so far, so quickly, and here is another great Australian invention creating hydrogen fuel just from the very air that we breathe. I think that's fantastic news for the world.
It's wonderful news, obviously, in the increasingly pressurized climate environment in which we live. But I wanted to add to this, and the reason why we've said the good news story this week is about air, because there are actually two good news stories. This I thought was just too amazing to pass up. How do you possibly choose between the big sponge that makes hydrogen fuel out of the air, even in a bone dry climate, and a experimental toaster-sized device that is currently being ported around the surface of Mars in the Mars rover, which is called MOXIE, which I absolutely love, which is short for Mars Oxygen in Situ Resource Utilization Experiment. And scientists from NASA have reported that this sort of toaster-sized machine that they have created can actually filter the carbon dioxide atmosphere of Mars into oxygen. They have created an oxygen filter that, just at the size they've got now, is essentially enough to provide enough air for a dog to live. So Fantastic. Part of the issue with Mars exploration, it's not just a question of getting there, it's a question of staying there, having a sustainable settlement if we are going to try a settlement on Mars, and how on earth we get back to Earth. If we fly people over to Mars, we've got to be able to get them home. And of course, You need oxygen to make rocket fuel. Well, this little toaster-sized MOXIE device that the Mars rover is carrying around, doing this experiment, filtering air, is the means by which they think that they're going to be able to set up oxygen production on Mars. They were like, it's the equivalent of a tree. They've essentially created a mechanical tree, and the implications of this for space travel and Mars settlement are extraordinary. Like, it's totally amazing. Science is great.
Science is great. And look, so many good news stories. Don't forget to send them to us. Of course, The Week on Wednesday continues to grow our audience every week. Of course, we have the weekend wrap every Sunday. The last couple of weeks, we've had some technical difficulties. We've got the episodes out, though. We appreciate everyone's support and understanding with all of that. And of course, The Week on Wednesday wouldn't be able to grow our audience without the support of you listening and our cadre supporters who chip in $20 a month, and our Extend the Reach supporters who chip in $10 a month, and of course our Buck a Week supporters who chip in a buck a week, and our one-off supporters as well. We are going to do a Week on Wednesday live at the Melbourne Fringe.
And the great thing about that is that we don't have to worry about the sound failing us because I have theatre training, and whatever happens, I will be able to get us through the Week on Wednesday live without interruption.
That's right. You will absolutely get that live experience, and we will try and get that broadcast out as well. But of course, Van, we want to acknowledge and congratulate and thank our Extend the Reach supporters. And have you got the list there in front of you?
I certainly do. Are you ready?
Let's do it. These are our cadre and then our Extend the Reach.
Karina Bali, at Jane C. Campbell, Leona Gibbons, Someone, Kathy Birch, Greg Miller, Fiona, at Evergreen V's, Geota, Jed Carney, Kristen Cole, Justin Dando, Tamara James, Bromwin, Punch Drunk Veteran, at Jenny Forster 7, Joe Fleming, Andrew Pascoe, Cassandra Tui, Addison Official, Ian Hampson, No Twitter for Me, Hannah Honda, Sam Herod, Alexandra Sutherland, Matt Bush, No Relation, Richard Sands, I'm Not on Twitter, Glenn Robbie, Brush Daniels, Collie Phillips, at Lee Archer, Linda Cartwright, at Leanne Shingles, Louise Miranda, Donna Chapman, I Don't Have Twitter, My Name is Susan Myers, at Kerry Nash 20, Billy 3, McCabe, Karen, Will Robinson, and Simon at Katagal, Lauren and Ash, Matthew Hadley, Naranga Man, John Sharpen, Peter Bath, Aaron Rollins, Louise Watson at Red, White and Blue Lou, and Stuart Munn at Vic M. Bitt, Adrian Valente, Maritza at Carriedale 68, Frank Nihuis, Erica Pizzuti, Claire, Joe Lupino, Steph, Rachel Fitzpatrick, Kerry Arthur, Pauline Bate, Kathy Birchie, Kirsten Black, Melanie Dinning, Jodie A. Karen, Penelope Judge, Jane Holloway, Spirit of Anger and Hope, Vicky Hanna at K Not, Love You Work at Didham, Sharon Kelly, Beck and Lola, hello Beck and Lola, Richard Graver, Someone, Ross Kenner 888, Kathy Burgess, Anna Uren, at Ange Fennell, Vita W, Tanya George, Nandita Hannum, Maura Louise Hawker, Megan Wickett, Graham Oxley, Beck Cody, Tracy Lucas, Sandy Heinen, at Galvest, Greg Martin, Trainer, Amy Fawcett, not on Twitter, Sarah, Elianen, Andrew, Ivor Spillett, Andrew Bryan, Peter O.C., Linda, Sam Hadid, Kier Patterson, Lizette Twizzle, Buncombe Basher, Katie Wood, The Real Never Longbody, Sandy Baumgart, at Not Sandy B, Renee McGee, and John DeHaan. There were lots of new names there.
It's fantastic. Every week we're getting more and more supporters, and it's because people like you listening right now are sharing, liking, leaving reviews and comments. Please keep doing that. It's really helping. We are frequently a top 3 politics podcast and frequently a top 20 news podcast in Australia. And we are beating out not just the Murdoch media, but people like Steve Bannon, and getting the message out about why it's important to join a union, what's really going on in our workplaces. And also, every now and again, we will give you those updates on big issues like the war in Ukraine and what's going on with the far right and the QAnon quonkers. Van, that's it for this particular episode of The Week on Wednesday. We will be back with the weekend wrap on Sunday. Until then, love you, Vanny.
I love you too. One day we'll be in the same room. Would that be amazing?
Bye.
Bye.